Poppy Bush and Baby Bush and the party. God, that spelled G for guns and O for oil and D for drugs. They gave us 911. Was an inside job.
George Bush in the White House spreading fear across the land, tearing up our Bill of Rights as fast as they can. Oh, terror, such a scam.
Well, Collins at the UN just showing diagrams. Can't you see those weapons just scattered across the land? He's making deals. He's shaking hands.
Got blood on his hands. Whoopies at the World Bank making new demands. We'll take your oil, you keep the sand.
We got Abu Ghraib in the Middle East, Guantanamo down south. Congress got that Patriot Act just shoved on down its mouth. They took our Constitution and threw it out.
Well, Karl Rove in the White House and they say he's Bush's brain. All his corporate buddies and their voting machines. We cast our votes, they wipe them clean.
Neo-Nazis stole the White House, now they're shooting for the world. Torture and police states and preemptive war. The Fourth Reich's here in America.
King George in the White House just pushing folks around. Chains in the backseat, polish in the crown. We're going down, we're going down.
Again, that was White House Blues, and that was Eric Carlstrom. And it was off his Bluegrass Conspiracy album. And tonight on Truth Quest, which this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida, and we've got a special guest on tonight. That's Sophia. And are you there, Sophia?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, great. I'm hoping to get you turned up just a little bit there so we can hear it. And then, of course, my introduction here. Oh, there we go. Sophia came to 9/11 as a novelty producer and professional writer with a novel and a couple of screenplays under her belt. She combined her abilities to produce 9/11 Mysteries, Demolitions, the first studio-style documentary on 9/11. The film evolved from a live presentation by the same name performed with a friend, Brad, for small audiences in Southern California throughout 2005. The live show gained international interest through its six-week run at the Progressive Met Theater in Hollywood. And Sophia and Eric, my co-host here, I also wanted to mention that the opinions expressed by the host and guests on this show do not necessarily represent the views of KHEN, its staff, or board of directors. Again, I want to thank Sophia, and I wanted to inject here that I like one of your presentation and your film is one of my favorites as far as presenting the facts with 9/11.
Well, thank you.
I can barely hear Sophia. Can you turn her up?
I've got her up just about as... Is that any better?
Hello, Sophia.
Yes, I can actually try to speak more.
Okay.
Some of the equipment here, we're fixing the upgrade a little bit, so even my earphones are...
Well, I've been involved in the 9-1 movement, but not nearly as much as you have, Sophia, because you've made this movie and you have... become kind of a part of the 9-1-1 truth movement, and recently you've come out with another DVD, a 14-hour DVD called The Science and Politics of 9-1-1, which takes some of the best speakers and talks from the 9-1-1 conference that was in Madison, Wisconsin, I think early August of 2007. I think the title was What's Controversial and What's Not, or something like that, 9-1-1, What's Controversial and What's Not, put on by Dr. Jim Fetzer, who's head of the 9-1-1 Scholars, or Scholars for 9-1-1 Truth. This was a sterling cast of speakers, and Sophia, for the last couple of days, I've been sitting down and watching the speakers on this excellent video. I would really like to see every American watch this 14 hours of video, because then I think we could start to have a real intelligent conversation about what's going on in our country. But Sophia, to kind of stop just rambling along here and asking some questions, you have been to a number of these conferences, is that correct? And how long have you been doing this?
Well, let me just backtrack a little bit. I kind of wear two hats. I made the movie 9/11 Mysteries, and yet before that I had the online store avatarproducts.com. And I sold a lot of DVDs that reflected, you know, alternative views of what's really going on in the world. And that collection has grown, and it includes 9/11 Mysteries, which is the film that I made. So when you say that I have come out with a new 14-hour DVD, that's not exactly right. This DVD that you're speaking of, the Madison, Wisconsin Conference of August 2007, was produced by Jim Fetzer, the founder of Scholars for Truth. And what he decided to do was invite all the big names of 9/11 to come and present their theories. Some of these theories were in diametric opposition to each other, so that these theories could be laid out by the experts themselves at a conference, and then the public or audience could decide what made sense and what didn't. And maybe it all makes sense, or maybe it all doesn't. So he produced a video, two DVD set that you have just referred to and that you've just watched, and I offered to distribute it for him through my online store. So I do believe in all kinds of opinions being aired so that the best material can sift to the top and we can form our theories based on what we have reviewed, all of us, collectively and individually.
Yeah,
so
we
to answer your second question, have I been to some conferences? Yes, not all of them.
You also have another website, is that correct?
I have a number of little websites. The big website that I operate is 911weknow.com, and then there's the store that links to it.
Okay.
So 911 We Know is the parent website of 911 Mysteries. They're both linked. 911 Mysteries is just part of 911 We Know.
I know when you first brought that video out, you'd mentioned maybe doing another follow-up one. Is that still going to be in the works? Or?
Well, part of this has to do with money. You know, it's one of those inevitable, unavoidable realities. And 9/11 Mysteries, because I sought to make it very kind of high quality, also cost me quite a bit of money in editing, music, and many other things. So if I am to come out with a sequel, I'm going to have to cough up a bunch of cash to do it. And the first time I did a video, Part one, I did this basically on credit cards and borrowing on my house. And as we all know, the economy is not a good thing to mess with. And so I don't look forward to borrowing over $100,000 again to make a movie. So this time it's going to have to be done with profit. So part one has to sell to pay for itself and then to fund part two.
Well, you know, this is a very interesting aspect of this thing. I have been to a number of the 911 conferences also, and I've noticed that, you know, there's speakers. Often the whole thing is in a fairly plush motel complex. There's nice restaurants. And there's a big room where many of the authors sell their books and movie makers like yourself sell their DVDs, et cetera. And it seems that there is a kind of a mini economy that has sprung up around 911. And I mean, this is where we are living in a capitalistic system. I guess we have to adjust to that. But it has struck me as being kind of strange, especially in Chandler, that we're talking about this horrendous mass murder, and we're at this kind of a country club environment. I guess the point of my question, Sophia, is why aren't there big donors helping us do this? Why do we have to write our own books and our own nickel and that sort of thing? Is all the money on the other side?
Well, if you think about it, the people who have deep pockets are usually nicely supported by the corrupt or crooked system, the system we are seeking to expose.
Yes.
So people with a lot of money are reluctant to help us expose the system that keeps them flush and fed. Therefore, we're up to, you know, it's up to us to figure out how to fund ourselves. And many people who seek to write books and so forth are not great at business. I happen to be lucky, as I'm told, that I have a side of me that can add and subtract. So I don't do too badly on that business end. But I never imagined that I would be any good. To me, it's just logic and common sense. The vendor hall that you spoke of in Chandler was quite an active place. And the market for information is tremendous. I am now including DVDs in my store that have nothing to do with 9/11. And I'm promoting topics like money. I just did a mass marketing for In Debt We Trust, a video by Danny Schechter. And it's excellent. It's about the credit card industry. And just this last couple of days, I have sent out an emailing on the beautiful video by the wife of Jerry Garcia, Deborah Coons Garcia, called The Future of Food, about genetically engineered seeds and
farming. That's a great movie, yeah.
And, you know, there are so many topics. This is why I call it the endless rabbit hole. And once you enter, you will be introduced to another topic and another. They're all linked. It's an incredible filigree of linked sense, as opposed to the nonsense we've all been living in that has made us feel like the world is, that life is futile, you know? That expression, life's a bitch and then you die, well, when you know about the rabbit hole, it doesn't feel that way anymore. It's enlightening.
Yeah, you have a link on your website called Down the Rabbit Hole, as just on your website, 911 We Know, and you get into some very interesting topics there, such as chemtrails. And what are some of the other topics that you jump into on that Down the Rabbit Hole?
Well, I recently put up a summary of the spraying that's being done in California, supposedly for this little insect called the light brown apple moth, LBAM. Arnold Schwarzenegger has taken a virulent dislike to the light brown apple moth, and he has decided that controlling the mating behavior of this moth, which hasn't caused a dollar of damage yet in California, warrants $3.5 million from the taxpayers each time we, the taxpayers, are sprayed for control of the moth. And we're going to be sprayed till 2010, and they're spraying urban and suburban areas, not agricultural areas, where the moth is, I suppose, would be presumed to live. And the chemical they're using is untested. It's called Checkmate, and it is an endocrine disruptor. It acts on women's reproductive cycles. It affects estrogen production. And many, many women up and down the California coast have reported rather bizarre and uncomfortable and worse symptoms from being sprayed. So the question is, why are human populations being sprayed for a moth? Why is it affecting human reproductive systems, although they're telling us it's for moths? And you would have to conclude that this has something to do with airborne infertility measures.
Kind of sounds that way, doesn't it?
Sorry?
It kind of sounds that way, doesn't it?
Yes. So there are many sinister activities afoot, and it is up to the individual to start sniffing them out, because they're not going to be on the newspaper front page. So when you can start adding the dots up yourself, that becomes an exhilarating place to be. And that's what's happened to me. I could be wrong about absolutely everything, but I don't think so.
Well, go ahead.
I leave it up to others to decide whether I'm wrong or whether they're learning something.
Well, that's kind of what this 9-11, I mean, it may sound like we're kind of beating a dead horse with 9-11, but what is really important about it is that it was kind of an awakening for those of us that started asking questions, and then we started looking around and we realized there was questions to start asking on everything. It wasn't just about what happened on 9-11. And I think that's what you're kind of bringing up.
It changes your languaging about the world. It's, as I say, it's the portal into consciousness, 9-11, because we all heard about it. You know, even though there are supposedly teenagers today who don't remember what year it was or what it was really about. But most people have at least heard of it, and they associate it with Arab terrorists, which remains to be proven. And it's the gateway into all of this. If you can go down that trail and start making discoveries, and then you start adding other things up, your entire world changes.
Right. And when you started, I found when I started looking into some of the information on that, I found that, you know, a lot of my belief system was radically changed in all areas.
We talked just a little bit earlier, Sophia, when we were just before the show, about one of our previous guests. We've had several of the guests on this show that were at that medicine conference, including Lorraine Murray and Alfred Weber and Doug Rocky and Jim Fetzer and a few others. So the quality of our guests has been quite good. And we've had I'm sorry, I just lost the thread of what I'm saying. I must be tired. When we had Alfred Weber, he gave us a big picture to kind of hang these questions on. And when I watched the video, the Madison, Wisconsin video, I was really floored that he seems to have put the skeleton of an answer together as to who's guilty and what they're up to. And he actually seems to have an International War Tribes Tribunal, War Crimes Tribunal in operation. So it seems that within the movement, the 9-1-1 movement, we're starting to see potential solutions to the problem. Would you feel optimistic about that?
Well, again, Alfred Weber, I don't think is considered necessarily part of the 9-1-1 movement. He is a guest at lectures. He is a brilliant man with a tremendous grasp of the big picture, as you put it. And there are people who are averse to what Alfred Weber has to say. He does talk about the militarization of space. He refers to extraterrestrials. All this material is unwelcome in the very simplified, formulaic version of the alternative explanation of 9-11. And the 9-11 movement is prone to keeping its message as simple as possible, such that those facts themselves do not get contaminated by or debunked because they are associated with ideas that the public at large is incapable of handling. You see, when you enter the rabbit hole, you have to take small steps. You can't be assaulted with the entire panorama of what's false and what's really happening.
Very good point. But and I know what I was trying to get at before was that in our conversation before we started the show, I mentioned to you that Lorraine Murray, one of our previous guests who was at this conference, had said in her interview with us that that basically the 911 movement was a COINTELPRO. She talked about the movement being equivalent to the counterintelligence programs of the FBI back in the 60s and 70s. And so, and you agreed that, yes, the movement is heavily infiltrated. So then this sets up a problem, and the problem is who do you believe and who do you not believe? And how, of course, you know, hopefully we all, you know, science will triumph in the end and we will have the correct answer. But meanwhile, other 911-like crimes can be committed. So there is some pressure to find the truth as soon as we can. So how do you sift through the agents, the infiltrators from the real researchers?
Well, I'm never going to answer your questions directly if you don't mind. I'm always going to make you backtrack. So first I'm going to address this notion of truth. All right? Truth is reductive. If I tell you, Eric, this is the truth right here, this little thing, this pinpoint, this is what you need to believe, you're going to resist that because I'm making you go there. Truth to me is an expanding reality. It's not reductive. Let's say I told you that I robbed your house yesterday, and you knew someone robbed your house because the door was jimmied and there were fingerprints that the police took and your stereo and whatnot were all gone. So you learned from me the next day that I was the one who did it, and you were furious. You wanted to see me behind bars. You want your stuff back. You feel violated, et cetera, et cetera. What if you learn the next day that I am mind-controlled or I fall into trance and I do whatever so-and-so tells me to do? Then who really robbed your house? So as the picture expands, truth becomes something that expands also. It's not something that reduces. And therefore, when you say we have to find out the truth as fast as possible, we can't ever do that because truth is actually relative. It's not reductive. So who do you trust in this? You know, I was a book editor before I became a filmmaker, which was a fluke, and I edited a book on depression. I had to read that book 7 times. It was eventually bought by Hyperion, and the title is Depression is a Choice. I learned from that book many, many things. And one of the things was that you're alone in the universe. You think you have friends, you think you have family, but really your entire life is based on what you choose to do. And only you. So we are alone in the universe. We are alone in the 9/11 movement. It is a grassroots movement. It's organic. It cannot be marshaled and it cannot be controlled. It can be infiltrated. It can be joined by many, many people. But what it does is something that it itself is going to determine because it's an organic thing. So who do you trust? You have to go by your gut. You are going to make mistakes. It really doesn't matter. The impetus for this information getting out, and I can tell you as a vendor of DVDs and books, the impetus is enormous, and it's never going to be stopped.
Yeah, I just have to tell a little story. Right at the end of the Chandler conference, I finally went up to Dr. Stephen Jones, who was, you know, somewhat of a celebrity there and was having his picture taken, et cetera. I finally just crashed into his personal space and introduced myself. This was near the end of the conference, and he's the guy who was the physicist from Brigham Young University who became quite an important figure in the Scholars for 911 Truth a couple years ago. And when he said this was done by, you know, a thermite controlled demolition to take down the towers. Anyway, I said, you know, I've been working on a book, and I also am in academics. Do you suppose that if I finish the book, I'll lose my job? And he kind of laughed and said, probably. And the other guy next to him said, yeah, but you can make a living selling your book. Good news, bad news, you know. So I'm walking that fence as an academic. Yes, I've got a manuscript that could easily be published, and yes, I'm about ready to publish it, but there's a certain amount of concern, you know, that this might be the thing that gets me fired. So,
does it really matter? I mean, you being employed as an academic is part of the old paradigm, in a way, you know? And we make the world every moment. I don't mean to sound too New Age here, but really and truly, it doesn't matter. I was a starving, struggling writer. I did some editing. I did some word processing. I did all the things that people do who are waiting for their break. And in the end, the break occurred because of me. I invested in myself. I made a movie. I did everything. I paid for it. I hired people to do the things I couldn't do. But it doesn't matter what we lose as the world rushes into this vortex, because we're all going into another way of being. We have to, because this way is not going to last.
I think you're right. You're right. Of course, I need to finish my book and not worry about the consequences to my career. You're right about that. But I bring up the story because it's just kind of relevant, and because this other guy seemed to think there was a living in writing a book like that. And who knows? But one has to do what one has to do, regardless of, you know, how it's going to pan out. You don't know how it's going to pan out. You take a gamble, as you did, I guess. Right.
Well, for me, I guess in some ways, the part of me that people call the artist was in control. I could see how that movie needed to be. And I drove myself and all things until I could get that to happen. So my belief is, personally, if you can see it in your mind, then you're going to do fine. As long as you don't cave in or quit or fall apart before you get to where to what you see. And that's the basic, you know, principle of creating your life, this creative visualization, as it's called. I didn't understand it 20 years ago, but I kind of understand it a lot better now. You have to see it. If you can't see it, you can't get there.
Well, yeah, excellent. But going back to the 911 movement, I don't consider myself part of the 911 movement, and yet I have been doing research on this since, just practically since 911. But I've deliberately stayed out of it, and I've noticed, you know, Scholars for 911 Truth and various subgroups, Pilots for 911 Truth and whatever. I've noticed a certain number of individuals have become the luminaries in this movement. Jim Hoffman for a while was the big thing for a while because of how the Twin Towers came down, and he talked about how they fell into their footprint in a controlled demolition, blah, blah, blah. And Stephen Jones was the guru then, the physics professor who legitimized that idea. And David Ray Griffin, the theologian from Santa Clara College, comes in and writes a couple great books about the new Pearl Harbor and the fraudulence of the 911 Commission. And so you get these individuals who come into the movement, and all of a sudden they are kind of elevated to superstar status, or at least star status. I don't know what to make of this. I really don't. I don't know what to make of conferences at posh hotels where we are talking about mass murder and a program to enslave the world as if we're talking about some other academic subject. It's so bizarre to me that it has a life of its own, obviously. What do you make of all of that?
Well, I'm going to ask you, as I said, I'm never going to answer your questions directly.
Uh-oh.
the the movement, if you want to call it a movement, I don't believe it's an organized movement. I believe that it coheres because of a mutual interest among a lot of people. And they embrace individuals with credentials, like physics professor, theologian. David Ray Griffin is a very highly intelligent man who has written numerous books. He's highly revered. He's a professor of religion and philosophy and whatnot. So, I mean, you can't go wrong with somebody like that embracing the alternative explanations of 9/11. And then now we have Richard Gage, the architect. So the movement, as we can loosely call it, embraces people who come in with these kinds of credentials because they feel that the public will have to believe someone who's a physics professor, will have to believe someone who's an architect. And that's why these individuals become luminaries or gain this kind of elevated status, because they are very helpful in that regard. Does that make sense to you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I don't want to detract at all from the work that these individuals have done, especially, you know, David Ray Griffin has, you know, he's a very productive scholar, and he's done a lot of work on this, and as has Jim Fetzer most of the others that are in the, Jim Mars has written a book about it, and David Von Kleist has gotten several good videos on it, and these people are productive. They have got something that they've put out to the public, and so it does make sense that they should become the luminaries. But when you say the 9-1-1 movement is this organic thing that you have to kind of interface with in kind of a cautious way, for instance, you would maybe not feel comfortable saying how you believe the Twin Towers came down because you might offend this group or you might offend that group. This is an interesting phenomenon to me.
There are individuals within the movement who are, you could call them organizers or some of the luminaries, who feel that the basics of what is put out to the public, those basics need to be kept simple and clean. And the simpler and the cleaner, the more easily the public will take to the alternative explanations of 9/11. So I understand that. However, life isn't simple and it isn't clean. I mean, children somehow find out that the stork doesn't bring babies. And the public can't be treated like little children and expected to believe in the stork, which we could kind of equate to the official story, or some other very simplified version of what might have happened. What might have happened, we don't even know. We weren't there. We're not privy to these secrets and plans, and there were many possibilities. There are many possibilities. So those who discuss the more far-reaching ideas tend to be ostracized or shushed or demonized because those ideas are too much for the little children public to try to assimilate or absorb.
Sophia, can you tell me, I don't want to be gossip here, but who are the ones that are trying to filter the arguments so that we don't confuse the simple-minded public?
I am not going to go into the area of naming names. I have spoken to many, many people in the movement, luminaries, organizers, and then my customers, who are wonderful human beings. They're just not well known. And I get the impression that there's a lot of concern about what should be discussed and what shouldn't. And those who are more, one could say, open-minded feel that everything should be discussed so that the best theories can be brought into the light. That's my own personal feeling. But I am not, I can't speak for other people. I can only tell you that it's quite clear that there's a lot of alarm currently, and Judy Wood has presented some very interesting findings, which I would put on one end of the spectrum, and I would put Stephen Jones' work, his very dedicated, methodical work, on the other end of the very same spectrum, okay? Stephen Jones has a baggie or two of dust, and he is able to delve into that plastic baggie and find a universe of possibilities and proof. He has found the fingerprints of HTAs, high temperature accelerants, fluorine, manganese, potassium. These are all things that are used or are residues of thermite incendiaries. So that's all very believable. And Judy Wood is on the other end of the spectrum. She's a person who has cataloged probably more photographs of the site than any other human being. She has reviewed and reviewed and reviewed. She could probably tell you when a picture was taken because of where a piece of equipment was located. She discovered that fill dirt was being brought in from the beginning. Trucks were coming in with low dirt loads in them covered by tarps, and the dirt was being scattered, and this was obvious in photos that she looked at, that dirt, fresh dirt, was being scattered around the site, and that dirt was being exchanged, removed, new dirt brought in, and apparently it goes on to this day. They still haven't built anything there, and so one has to ask oneself, what is fill dirt about? It's a decontamination activity. What are they decontaminating?
Well, I heard they did a lot of, there was millions of gallons of water that was used, too.
Right. And now that relates to, am I interrupting you?
No. Huh.
The whitish, ashy stuff, it looks to some people like steam, but I have talked to rescue workers, and they did not report that stuff as steam. They walk through it all the time. Steam is water turning to gas, and it's hot. When you use your iron and you put it on steam, it's hot. When you throw water on the coals in a sauna, immediately the temperature rises in there. So this material that was filtering skyward, which can be seen from satellite photographs at great altitudes, this spire of bluish-white matter, very fine particulate matter, rising, which would suggest that it is on its way up. It's very light. This stuff was being sprayed.
Sprayed?
And, yes. That's Judy Wood's theory.
Well, if I could just add something to that, Sophia, having just watched her talk on the DVD that you sell, she is kind of an advocate of directed energy weapons, which would be some form of lasers, masers, something like that, very high-tech exotic weapons that the black budget of the Pentagon has been working on for the past 40 years. She doesn't, in that particular talk, pull all the pieces together as well as she does in some of her papers. But she does talk about directed energy weapons. She talks about how there seems to be some kind of this white, fumy gas stuff coming out of the buildings just before they go down. They're kind of, she called it, lathering up the building. And then she suggests that this might form, well, this is pretty exotic, all right, some kind of a plasma which could then be set off. She has a phrase that she uses several times. 9-1-1 was not a new Pearl Harbor. It was a new Hiroshima. And she therefore implies that this This, what happened there is very much like what happened at Hiroshima, and she compares pictures. So then there's the implication that, well, maybe there's some also some nuclear explosion, perhaps with I don't know. Can you fill that out anymore?
No, I'm not Judy Wood. I can only tell you that the pulverization of the buildings was extreme, and Stephen Jones believes that thermite is powerful enough if the thermite is basically iron oxide and sulfur. That's thermate,
yeah.
And aluminum. And then with heat added, the chemical composition changes and it becomes aluminum oxide and iron or molten iron. So he believes that if you add enough sulfur and if you granulate the compound, the thermite compound, enough, you can give it explosive characteristics. So whether it was thermite or whether it was something plus thermite, the pulverization of the towers was extreme. And you see, this is accounted for in the biological fate, biophysical reactions of the rescue workers. There were 40,000 people who showed up to help after the buildings came down, and 20,000 of them are already diagnosed with acute respiratory and other ailments. Most of them can't work. They are ailing seriously. Many have died. And I would argue that in a regular controlled demolition, after the dust settles and it's swept up, everybody goes home. People don't start dying, and they don't continue to die for years in these huge numbers.
What I was just going to say is that what I find really interesting is how little of that vast amount of dust there has been left to test. And I do know of certain people that have been trying to get it tested for isotopes and that sort, and they're not getting any help from labs or anything of that.
Right. Labs are strangely uncooperative when it comes to testing this and other materials. It almost is as though there's a moratorium issued, an edict across the country that 9/11 is a sealed deal, closed case. Do not reopen.
Well, they were even trying to send it across the over to outside of the country, and they're having problems.
I know. It's amazing. This has an eerie property to it, this issue of 9/11.
It really does. One of the things that Judy Wood brings out, Dr. Judy Wood, I should mention, who has her PhD in materials engineering, so Jim Fetzer thinks she is the most qualified scientist the one who's done the best work on 911, and I would agree. She says that the U.S. Geological Survey did not sample the dust at Ground Zero. They deliberately stayed away from that. And she talks a lot about the dust and the importance of this dust. She says what happened to the buildings was molecular dissociation.
Yes.
In other words, something that is completely out of the realm of our normal experience as human beings. In other words, it seems that there are now exotic weapons that the government controls, or some government controls, or maybe it's Spectre or Smersh, who knows, that can reduce the two of the strongest, sturdiest towers in the history of the world to dust in 10 seconds. And she says these towers did not collapse. She says they went away. They disappeared. They vaporized. They did not collapse, because the wave of destruction coming down, you can see it. And as you say, she's got all these photos cataloged from the event and subsequent days. The demolition wave, quote unquote, is faster than the speed of gravity. So the upper part of the tower is being completely demolished into very, very, very fine dust particles before the bottom part of the tower is affected at all. So what's going on here is is not within our realm of sense experience. And to me, this argues, to me, as a scientist, Judy Wood is on the spectrum, which is probably on the right trail, where Steve Jones is probably not. That I will say that.
Well, then, I think that, you know, there's room for both of them. There's every possibility that thermite plus some other process was used.
And yes, you're right.
There are experts in all different disciplines.
Right.
Judy Wood is someone who has been able to language more creatively. When she says the buildings disappeared, this is something that we would all laugh off and say, no, they didn't. Nothing disappeared. But she's pointing out a very kind of extremely quick pulverization. So it's an accurate word in some ways, you know? Not everyone can talk like that. And yet she shouldn't be criticized for speaking in this way, because she's pointing out some very salient things.
What?
No, you're absolutely right, and I would encourage everybody to buy the video from you and to listen to Dr. Judy Wood's talk. She is very creative with language, and she uses different words because she realizes that words are loaded with interpretation, and so she'll deliberately find a simpler, almost elementary school-type word that is not loaded with a particular interpretation, so that people can look at this thing with an open mind now, instead of judging and concluding how things happened before they get the data. Her genius is to get as much data as possible to understand really what happened there. She talks about the 14 toasted cars, and she means toasted in the sense of these are mangled, wrinkled, completely now dysfunctional cars. She has a very clever way. A great metaphor. She talks about the Twin Towers being like two sequoia trees that couldn't be taken down by being hit by an airplane any more than a sequoia tree could be taken down by being shot with a bullet. I mean, she has these great analogies.
Right.
And yet she's a PhD with more credentials than anyone else in the movement. So it's a wonderful juxtaposition of understandable, and at the same time she has the range of knowledge of how materials work. What's the melting point of steel, the boiling point of this and that and the other. She understands these things.
Well, and right, but Stephen Jones is a physicist. He's capable of understanding the same things as well. He knows the melting point of steel. We have to give him credit. He's not uncredentialed. He's just operating, as I said, on another part of the spectrum. The two are not mutually exclusive. That's my belief.
Yeah. Well, that's good. I thanks for that perspective. Yeah.
I was wondering if I've noticed something in one of the films that there was an eerie sound after one of the I think one of the buildings came down before the second one came down. I'm not sure. Somewhere in there was this really eerie, strange sound that I've seen on a film or two. Have you run across what I'm talking about? It's kind of a whistling, weird sound.
Have you heard that?
Yes.
I think now that you mention this, that I've heard something about it, but I couldn't tell you what that sound was. I don't remember hearing it myself, although maybe it's on those videos and it hasn't registered.
Well, I've not heard anybody else speak of it, and yet to me it was a very distinct a thing to notice, and yet I've not...
So this is something you observed yourself?
Right.
Oh, I see. Well, that's something to put up on YouTube, Melody.
Well, I think that's where I saw the video. I think it was somebody that was, there were some emergency workers, and that was a sound that was taking place, and it was covered with dust at the time, and it was real gray after, I believe, the first... building came down before the second one did.
What was covered with dust? The area?
Yeah, the area.
So the sound wasn't related to emergency vehicles?
No, no, not at all. It was it was something real strange and different.
Otherworldly?
Yes.
Well, it could. If you could find that video and invite others to listen, that would be helpful.
Okay.
Let me ask you to stretch your mind here, Sophia, if you would. I don't know if you want to answer this question. You talk about the rabbit hole. You talk about chemtrails. Is there a potential link between chemtrails and 911?
Well, there are links in that these are evidently programs that were carried out, secret programs, covert operations, and chemtrails are ongoing, and in some ways 9/11 is ongoing as well because its ramifications are, you know, the Patriot Act and the global war on terror and many other things, the arrival of the police state. But whether you want me to link them in terms of science, I'm not qualified really to do that, except that I can tell you that there is science going on that we have no grasp of. I would even venture to say that our professors in our academic institutions, who may feel that they are qualified to comment on a lot of things, I am sure have no knowledge of what is really available to humanity and that is completely kept out of reach of lay people. Occasionally they make movies in Hollywood, and I think this is a very kind of bizarre, almost like a perversion, that they will make a movie that is considered science fiction, but years later we will realize that that's actually going on for us.
Well, I think that's kind of the message that Alfred Weber gets tied into this scenario, because he's kind of representing the Disclosure Project. Or he was. I don't know if he still is, but I know he's definitely affiliated with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and that is where your otherworldly things, that black op budgets and that sort into space programs and things of that sort, is where he has kind of gotten involved.
I just finished watching the movie on chemtrails that you were generous enough to send along with the 911 sequence, and I think it's called Chemtrails, Aerosol Crimes.
Yes.
And it's put together by a guy named Clifford Carnicom. It's well done. He's a journalist of 30 years, and he's been working on this. He moved to New Mexico, where the sky was blue always, and then fairly quickly thereafter, he started seeing these chemtrails just turn the sky to kind of a milky white, and he's been doing a lot of research on it. He has a quote in there that I wrote down because I thought it was interesting, especially from the point of view that he's a reporter. He says, "This is the biggest story in recorded human history. You have an entire planet covered by whatever, by whoever, and nobody is even acknowledging it. What the heck is going on, and how come we don't know?"
Right. Actually, Clifford is a research scientist. He was employed with the Department of Defense for 15 years in a field of geophysics called geodetics, earth sciences.
Okay.
Yes, so he is uniquely qualified to make these observations, and yet now as a civilian, there are a lot of limitations on us, on civilians, when it comes to trying to sample the chemtrail material. Of course, the material is being sprayed at a high altitude. We don't own jets. We have to observe, and we have to try to catch fallout from the air, and this becomes a difficult thing. But Clifford has obtained samples. He has tested them. He has some new posts on his website, carnicom.com, carnicom.com. There is apparently a disease called Morgellons, M-O-R-G-E-L-L-O-N-S, Morgellons disease, that actually ABC TV had a special on it about a week or 10 days ago. It is now being admitted to as real by the CDC, although we are told that these strange fibers that grow out of these blotchy sores on people's bodies, nobody knows the nature of.
There are some that describe it as kind of a silicone base.
Yes. And yet, the debunkers, of course, there are plenty of those, and many have credentials and advanced degrees, are saying that Morgellons patients are delusional. They are mere hypochondriacs who break out in rashes, gooey rashes, and their clothing, lint from their clothing, sticks to the rashes.
But they like to do that to just about anybody that comes out with some sort of a condition or disease is to accuse them initially of being delusional. That seems to be kind of a standard initial response.
Well, I like the lint part. And Hildegard Stanninger, who's an industrial toxicologist, she's quite wonderfully credentialed. She states that these polymer whiskers that grow out of the sores do not burn under 1,200 degrees. So I'd like to see some lint that stands up to 1,200 degrees.
Jeff Rinsight has a lot of information on following the developments of this condition.
Just for our listeners who may not be very familiar with the whole chemtrails issue, as I really haven't been, even though I've been teaching climatology, a good example of one of your ignorant professors. From what I get from the DVD, Carnicom has found that components of the chemtrails, which are, of course, emitted by jets 35 to 40,000 feet, include water-loving metallic salts that are solid, but they also include other things. They seem to have a biological component, which some identify as a fungus. There's some that have very unusual filaments. Some components are gels, some are crystals, and some are powders.
I've heard barium is.
Yeah, you have metals. Yeah, you have metals.
But there's
aluminum.
Another element that Clifford found early on in the chemtrail fallout, which is desiccated erythrocytes or human red blood corpuscles that are of a freeze-dried nature, desiccated. And why that is in the chemtrails puzzled him more than anything. And now in his recent Morgellons work, which has consisted of taking blood samples from healthy people as well as Morgellons patients, he has found anomalies in the blood of healthy people to be the very same, although at earlier stages of development, as the anomalies in the Morgellons patient. So this may correlate with why there is red blood material being dropped on us. It's very, very, I would have to say, diabolical. But to go back to chemtrails, there is a, stork explanation for chemtrails that I think the